Right, so I was asked to do a class on the reliability and inspiration of the Bible. Oh, wow. Shh, please. Please, even if you're not sitting, can you stop talking? Thank you. Now, I just did a class on this topic in San Diego. Here it is. I've got 47 pages worth of notes. So I have to trim it down. It's about a 9 or 10 hour class. A 9 or 10 hour class on the reliability and inspiration of the Bible. So I'm going to trim about 90% of that out and just do a very basic treatment of mainly not the inspiration and inerrancy, although that's a very important topic, and inerrancy, you know, like whether or not there are errors in the Bible. That's a very important question. But I just don't have time to deal with that, and I want to take some questions from the audience. So, I'm going to spend some time on the reliability of the Bible. In other words, how do we know that the Bible we have in front of us is, you know, represents what was originally written? And the whole idea, the whole concept of Scripture really comes from Judaism, and therefore also Christianity. The idea of a canon. A defined canon largely comes from Christianity. If you tried to find the Buddhist canon, you could fill all these walls from all the way from left to right, the entire thing, and that would be just one of the canons of Buddhism. But it's really a bunch of people just stating their opinions. And of course, in Hinduism, you have the Puranas and the Vedas and the Upanishads and all these. So the idea of a scripture that you can rely on, that you sort of have a paper trail. But the very concept has to do with Christianity, whereas other religions, which we won't talk about tonight, that they don't have anything even remotely like this. Anyway, so I'm going to talk about the New Testament documents, the reliability of the New Testament, the formation of the New Testament canon, the reliability of the Old Testament documents, the formation of the Old Testament canon, and things like that. I'll also talk a little bit about the Apocrypha and how the Apocrypha and its existence actually gives us more confidence, not less, in the reliability of the Bible. Okay? So that's the main thing we're doing. All right? I'm going to skip all these things. Now, you hear these things. People say that the Gospels were written in the second century. Did this movie, The Da Vinci Code, did it ever get here in India? Mm-hmm. All right, that's crazy. That's, you know, the idea that Constantine changed the New Testament, the idea of, what are some of the things in that movie? I don't remember when the Gospel of Judas came out a few years ago. They're claiming this is just another Gospel, just like, you know, there's the four accepted ones, but that's just because, you know, the Orthodox Church won out, they suppressed all the others. This is really quite nonsense. This is fully nonsense. Doesn't make any sense. I don't want to talk about that. Is Judas another gospel? Some of these alternative versions, Thomas, Philip, Judas, may have circulated more widely than the familiar four gospels. I mean, people say this kind of stuff. This is nonsense. This is garbage. These things didn't even exist in the first century. All right? In fact, it is unclear whether the authors of any of the Gospels, even the familiar four, actually witnessed the events they describe. This is stuff that's National Geographic. It's all over the place in America. I'm sure it's going to leak over into India if it hasn't already. Right? The idea that, for example, that Jesus is a myth, where they took Krishna and Osiris and Mithra, kind of combined it all together to make that conglomerated Christian myth. This stuff, all right, we have to do that. Alright, the Gospel of Judas, I can talk about that, that's kind of fun, but what about the Gospel of Thomas? We'll talk about that. Some of the quotes from the Da Vinci Code. Almost everything our fathers taught us about Christ is false. Alright, we hear this stuff. Constantine turned Jesus into a deity who existed beyond the scope of the human world, an entity whose power was unchallengeable. That Constantine was the one who created this Jesus who's God. I'm not saying this is true, I'm just saying this is things people say. Right? And I'm going to show that this really doesn't make any sense. Speaking of the Council of Nicaea, my dear TV, until this moment in history, Jesus was viewed by his followers as a mortal prophet, a great and powerful man, but a man nevertheless. Garbage! Don't believe this stuff for a second. But that's easy to say. We have to have evidence for this, right? More than 80 Gospels were considered for the New Testament. Nonsense! There's no evidence for any of this. And, but I'm going to give you the evidence, all right? Right now I'm just talking. I'm kind of like Michael Shermer, just a bunch of rhetoric. We need physical evidence to back up what I'm talking about. All right, we're going to talk about manuscript evidence. I'm not going to take the time to define manuscript canon. By the way, canon comes from the word cane, which means ruler. And so measurement, how you measure the scripture, we'll talk about. When we talk about canonization, we're going to talk about, boom, firing off a canon. It's C-A-N-O-N, one end. So canonization is the process. For example, who chose the books in the Old Testament? And how can we trust them? Yeah. Who chose the books in the New Testament? What do we know about that? And how can we trust them? That's the idea of canonization. How we know about the word manuscript. A manuscript is any ancient document, basically. A codex. The codex, these were the first books. As you probably know, most of the very early manuscripts were written on papyrus. Most of those didn't survive simply because papyrus is a very, very fragile material. Most of the early documents are codices. Codex, what it was, is a very, very long strip of vellum. Vellum was made out of lamb's skin. They sewn together, they'd be like 50 feet long. Then they fold them up, kind of like an accordion. So imagine a very long, this tall and 50 feet wide. That'd be instead of doing a scroll, what the Jews did, they do a codex. So they fold it, and then fold it, and fold it, and fold it. So it'd be a book that you'd open up kind of like an accordion. That's what a codex is. So we'll talk about Codex Alexandrinus, Codex Vaticanus. A codex is a long piece of leather or papyrus. Usually leather if they survived. Basically, the earliest version of what we call a book. Papyrus, we know about vellum and parchment. That's what they made most of the codices out of. Uncial, cursive. Just to be aware of the earliest Greek manuscripts. The earliest Greek manuscripts, all the letters were capitalized. They had no spaces between the words and our paragraphs or anything. So an uncial, U-N-C-I-A-L, the earliest manuscripts are uncials, which are written using all capital Greek letters. And then the minuscule, that's kind of like what we have, at least when you write English. Forgive me when I say we. That is so arrogant for Americans to say we. What I mean is Americans. It's so terrible. But anyway. All right. The idea is that there's a capital and then a little letter after that. That would be minuscule. So there are many, many minuscule Greek manuscripts. That doesn't mean little tiny manuscripts. It means they have small letters and capital letters. But all the really, really ancient manuscripts were uncials. You don't need to memorize that word. We're not going to have a quiz. But I'm going to probably throw that word out there. And I don't like to use words that haven't defined. So there are some words. This is a minuscule manuscript. See that? Theta. Alright? And the small theta doesn't look like that. Let me see. Here's a capital Kappa. Alright? And this is a small lambda. Anyway, this is what an uncial looks like. And you can see why when the New Testament manuscripts were copied, it's hard to make an exact copy of an uncial. In fact, I'm going to show an example of if we were to write in all capital letters in any language, it would be actually kind of hard to read and also hard to copy with real precision. All right, this is a papyrus manuscript here. This is a vellum codex. These things look like books. And we have codices like this from the 4th century. Mm-hmm. In fact, entire Bibles from the 4th century. All right. Now, as far as the manuscript evidence for the New Testament, I want to give you a general feeling for how much evidence we have. We have a vast amount of evidence. Yeah. But for example, let's just pick any important ancient document. Let's say the writings of Julius Caesar. Omnia Gallia est divisa tres partes in base Latin. Oh, luckily for you, you didn't study Latin. Said, first to kill the Romans, now it's killing me, something like that. But anyway, that's a Latin joke. Never mind. Julius Caesar, written around 50 BC, we have roughly 10 copies. The oldest manuscript for Julius Caesar we have comes from 950 years. In other words, the oldest manuscript is AD 900, 950 years after Julius Caesar wrote. And when you read Julius Caesar in a Latin class, do they talk about, well, you can't really trust it, and, you know, how do we know he even wrote it, and, you know, how do we know he even wrote anything? People accept the writings of Julius Caesar gospel, as if he, that's exactly what he wrote. And nobody questions that. Seriously. All right, how about other ancient documents? How about the greatest of the Greek historians, Herodotus? He wrote around 435 BC. The oldest manuscript from Herodotus we have is 1,350 years after he died. That's a long time, folks.
Yeah.
And we have a total of 8 manuscripts. Aristotle. Everybody knows that, you know, Aristotle's book called Physics, and that's what he wrote. Really? Okay, nobody questions that. We have, believe it or not, we have only 5 Greek ancient manuscripts of Aristotle. Only 5. And the oldest of Aristotle's manuscripts we have are from almost 1,500 years after he died. Nobody questions the reliability of what Aristotle wrote. Everybody just assumes that's what he wrote. Why? Well, because it was translated to so many languages. All right, but that would mean it. Now, let's talk about the New Testament.
Wow.
All right, we're written somewhere between, actually, in the 40s to 90 AD. Wow. We have over 8,000 manuscripts.
Yeah.
And the oldest manuscript we have is 50 years after the original. Now, just look at the numbers here. You can kind of figure this thing out for yourself. The evidence we have for the reliability of the New Testament is 100 times better, and I'm not exaggerating, than the manuscript evidence we have from any ancient book, bar none.
Amen.
And people question the reliability of the New Testament. What's going on there? You know, it's amazing. If something is found in the New Testament, they assume it's all wrong. If they find it in any other ancient document, well, yeah, obviously. What? Who came up with that? All right, so we have a lot of manuscript evidence to support the reliability of the Bible, to say the least. Oh, my goodness gracious. It's crazy. All right, I gotta skip a few pages here. Oh, this is great. I'm already on page 8. No, I'm on page 9 now. We're making some pretty good progress. All right. So, this is the Rylands Papyrus. It's in Manchester, in the Rylands Museum. I got to see it. It's kind of cool. And this is from roughly 125. Now, the reason it's John 18, 31 through 33 and 37 is because there's the front and the back. Now, by the way, you cannot use this particular manuscript to prove the entire book of John that we have in Greek now is the same as it was in 125 AD. But what you can prove is, number one, it was written by then, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
Not only that, but you know, we can assume that there were many because these things were being passed around. So this is 50 years after the original. Now remember, the critics of the New Testament want to claim that the New Testament was changed in the 4th century by Constantine. In fact, I've had Hindus send things to my website saying that reincarnation things were removed from the Bible in the 4th century. That is total, utter nonsense. That makes no sense. Because we have hundreds of manuscripts from before that time. So they'd have to have removed all the references to reincarnation from hundreds of years before Constantine was even born.
Yeah.
This craziness. Doesn't make any sense. Here is the Sackler Library. It's a fragment of John from 150 AD. This is the Magdalene manuscript. Now, some have tried to date the Magdalene manuscript to 70 AD, but that's the very, very conservative number is 175 AD. We have some pieces of Matthew here, of the Chester Beatty papyrus. I mean, to me, it's like a kid in a candy shop. I went to the Chester Beatty Museum that's there in Dublin. Oh, it's got this room full of dozens of manuscripts from the 2nd and 3rd century. Dozens of them. This is just a few samples.
Wow.
2nd and 3rd century. Dozens of them. So this is 2 Corinthians 11, 33 through 39 from roughly 200 AD. Pretty impressive. And this is unshown, as opposed to minuscule. The Bodmer papyrus from 200 AD, that's a pretty cool one. I like the little flourishes they had here on the desk bottom. It's kind of nice, you know, that little cool stuff there. So that's, to be honest with you, I don't know how sure even which chapter number it is. All right. Now, here's an interesting thing. This was published just 4 years ago. In Egypt, they made mummies out of paper mache. You know what paper mache is? Like basically a mixture of flour and water and paper and make layers. Somebody thought, gee, well, let's see if there's anything on there. And they took one of these mummies and they found out part of the paper mache had pieces of Matthew. And it's been dated to 80 AD.
Wow.
Plus or minus 20. That's a fairly tentative number, but it's looking fairly solid. So what that means is, by 80 AD, roughly, not only was Matthew written, but it was being thrown out because it was so old. So we can assume, most likely, proved is a little bit strong, but we can say, beyond a reasonable doubt, most likely, that Matthew existed in hundreds, if not thousands of copies, enough that they were throwing them out, because it was worn out by 80 AD. So the idea that this is fabricated, somebody could have made a different kind of Jesus in the 2nd and 3rd century, it's not looking too good. Then we have the Codex Sinaiticus. And by the way, I was in the British Museum, and I took that picture, and then the guard came up and said, hey, no pictures, no sorry. He let me keep the camera. I was thankful for that. That's in the British Museum. This is an entire Old and New Testament, Now, of course, the Old Testament there is the Greek, is the Septuagint translation. I'll talk about that in a bit. So, arguably, the evidence for the Old Testament in this Codex Sinaiticus is, you know, it's more indirect because it's a Greek translation. Nevertheless, the story behind Codex Sinaiticus is called that because it was found on St. Catherine's Monastery on Mount Sinai. This was, I believe, in the late 1800s, maybe the mid-1800s. And there was a scholar there, and he found it in the trash can. It was about to be thrown out.
Mm-hmm.
All right, burned, actually. Pretty amazing. So we have entire New Testaments, from 350 AD, Codex Sinaiticus, Codex Vezae from around 400 AD. So this is kind of a quick summary, just to give you a general feeling for the different manuscripts we have. All right, Rhymus Papyrus, Chester Beatty. I didn't list the mask of Matthew from 80 AD. All right, so the bottom line is, the amount of manuscript evidence we have to support the general reliability of the New Testament is fantastically strong.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? I didn't mention Codex Vaticanus, which is so called because it's in the Vatican, which is an entire New Testament from the first half of the 300s. And then there's Codex Alexandrinus, because it was found in Alexandria, which is also in the British Museum, from the second half of the 300s AD. There's the Washington manuscripts, the Ephraim Codex, all these others in my notes I won't go over. The bottom line is we have hundreds of manuscripts from the first four centuries, and many dozens of manuscripts, even from the, I'd say a couple of dozen manuscripts from the second century, and possibly even one from the first century. Yes?
Can you please tell us what this codex means?
Remember, it's that not all these manuscripts are codexes. For example, the Rylands Papyrus was not from a codex. A codex was a long strip. Imagine they take many, many hides of a calf,
or a lamb. And they sew them together and they cut it, a strip as wide as this room is, like this. And then they fold it back and forth, back and forth. So it's not exactly like a book where you have a binding. It's a book more like an accordion.
So it's more a form of...
It's like a book. It's the earliest form of book. Before that, you had scrolls.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, kind of the history there, because when up until around the 4th century, the Jews only had scrolls. So for us, when we say turn to Matthew 5, verse 36, we flip the pages, right? They couldn't do that. And so you start to see the New Testament, you see the early church fathers starting to quote scriptures, that, and it reflects that they assume the people in their audience essentially had books available to them.
Yeah.
Because before that, they literally, there was no such thing as a book. And so, anyway, that's part of the history of writing. Okay. Now, there are different text types, and you have to realize that not all these manuscripts are identical. They're not identical. There are mistakes. Right? There are mistakes. The oldest manuscripts have errors in them. Now, is this inspired?
Yes.
It's a trick question. The answer is no. It's a translation.
Oh, is it inspired?
It's a trick question, okay? And with baby Christians, don't even tell them this, maybe, you know, careful, I reveal this information. This is a translation. Are the translators inspired?
Not true.
No.
No. All right. So what is inspired? Well, we believe that the original, we call them the autographs.
Mm-hmm.
The original Matthew that was written, the original Philippians that was written, the original Isaiah that was written. We don't have those. We have copies of copies of copies. And are they perfect?
No,
they're not. Did you know that we have, we basically have virtually no quotes originally from Jesus? What language did Jesus speak?
Aramaic.
Do we have any direct quotes? Well, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani. Oh, okay. Now again, don't tell baby Christians this right away, but sort of ease them into this, you know what I'm saying? The question is not whether that's exactly what Jesus said. The fact is, we generally don't know exactly what he said. First of all, if you're reading in English or in Hindi, which is a translation of a translation, because the Greek, in essence, was a translation. It's Matthew's version in Greek of what Jesus said. So the question is the original inspired or not? Number one. And I believe it is, and we have fantastic evidence for that. And number two, how close a version of the original do we have? That's what I'm talking about here. Inspiration is a separate thing, inerrancy is a separate thing. We're talking about the reliability. There are different text types. For example, there are New Testament texts. They're called Alexandrine because they were found mainly in Alexandria. And, for example, Codex Bezae. Where is that? Is that there? Yeah. This one here... There's some noticeable trends. It's kind of like a genealogy, right? The human, humans kind of branched off a little bit. I'm looking around in the room. I'm seeing there's two Europeans in this room. It's kind of noticeable, and the rest of us aren't, I guess, probably. Right? And so there are text types. For example, Codex Bezae is Western. In other words, there's certain minor, just, I'm going to talk about how minor. These are truly minor. There's certain little tiny things, like copy mistakes, like for example, a word that's spelled incorrectly, or two words that got reversed, these kinds of things. But you can actually tell. For example, you can kind of tell. Everybody in this room knows who the two Europeans are, right? We all know. We're not looking at the other ones, but there's two of us in here. All right? And you can tell. And so that's true. Let me get to the cut to the chase here.
All right, for example, let's talk about Muslims. They believe they have a perfect Quran.
You know why they believe that? Because Uthman, who was, I believe, the fourth caliph, he basically burned all the copies and made exactly one, and he says, this is the only one, and basically anybody who uses another one, they get killed. So, and do Muslims talk about the errors that came into the Quran? No, they pretend there aren't any. Whereas if Christians, what do? We have thousands and thousands of manuscripts. We study them all, and we try to use all this evidence to reproduce the original. And the amount of... that's interesting. It would have been less distracting to stand up and walk in place. That's okay. But I appreciate his heart. And the fact is, in Islam, they have virtually no manuscript evidence. I mean, put it this way. Let's say you have a court proceeding. If you have five different witnesses, if all their stories are exactly the same, what's that tell you? They colluded. They put their story together. I've been on juries three different times. I keep getting picked. I'm constantly picked for jury duty. And when you have a trial, the witnesses, they have a little bit different perspective. And what that tells you is they're not lying. We have four gospels. They're independent witnesses to the same events.
Yeah.
Are there slight differences? Of course there are. A different perspective.
Yeah.
If they were the same, then why even bother having four gospels? I mean, seriously. But anyway, I'm getting off my point. So we have, the bottom line is there are differences, okay? By the way, we don't just have Greek manuscripts. We also have translations. For example, the New Testament was translated into Coptic in the 2nd century. It's a fact. We know for a fact that it was translated into Coptic in the 2nd century. It's like a snapshot. Thank you for taking a picture. That was my point. All right, because the Coptic translation is a snapshot of the New Testament in the 2nd century. All right, we have Syriac translations also from the 2nd century. We have Latin, although we use the Vulgate, Latin, which is from the 4th century. There are Latin manuscripts from the 2nd century. And these, I mean, it's a translation, but the translation is further evidence to support, you know, which, let's say there's some slight variations in the Greek, we can look at a translation, and it might help to fill in some information. Okay, so we have more information there. Also, we have the quotes of the church fathers. For example, Clement of Rome, who wrote a letter in either 95 or 96 AD, it's the first century, he quotes from Matthew, Mark, Luke, Acts, Romans, 1 Corinthians, Hebrews, James, 1 Timothy. So, first of all, that tells me that all those books existed. Clement, he quotes extensively from the Old Testament and quite a bit from the New Testament. And he treats the Old Testament and the New Testament equally. In other words, we know for a fact that the New Testament was considered canonical, you know, inspired scripture by the end of the first century. That's an undeniable fact. Okay, Ignatius, writing it in 108 AD, he quoted from Ephesians, Matthew, Luke, John, Romans, 1 Corinthians, Ephesians, 2 Timothy, James, 1 Peter. Also quoted, that's just in one. He wrote several letters. This is just one letter. And then he quoted from 1 Timothy, 2 Thessalonians, Acts. And basically, Ignatius quoted like three quarters of the New Testament books. And this does two things. First of all, let's say you want to claim that that Constantine changed the New Testament in the 4th century. Well, what you have to do is, not only would you have to wipe out all the old manuscripts and just make them go away, which is impossible, obviously, because you'd have to get the church to agree to burn all the manuscripts. Good luck with that. But also, you'd have to take out all these letters that anybody ever wrote quoting the New Testament, of which we have hundreds and hundreds of these things. Further strong evidence to the reliability of the Bible. It's been said, I've got a new slide here, Polycarp, who wrote in AD 120, close to all these books,
Irenaeus in 180, he quoted from all the books. In fact, it's been estimated that if you take the manuscripts in the first 3 centuries, you could reproduce virtually the entire New Testament just from those manuscripts. In other words, if we lost all of our Bibles, if there were no Greek manuscripts at all, you could reproduce virtually the entire Greek New Testament just from the quotes. All right? So, this is further evidence. And now let's get to these mistakes. You'll see on the internet over 200,000 mistakes in the New Testament. Right, but there's 8,000 manuscripts. So let's divide 200,000 by 8,000. Then maybe it's not so big anymore. Oh, it's only 12 mistakes per manuscript. Okay, well okay. And you know, this is a piece of Codex Sinaiticus. And here's my example. Not everyone who says the Lord, Lord, life to the kingdom of heaven, only those who do the will of the Father in heaven. Now, if you're copying that, it'd be fairly easy to make a mistake. I mean, if you have words and you know, sentences and punctuation and words separated with a space, then it's a lot easier to make a perfect copy. But it was really easy to have a line repeated. It was also easy to skip a line, because there's very little context. Because when they were making a manuscript, they were literally just copying the letter, copying the next letter, copying the next letter, copying the next letter. Now, you know that they went over and read it to see if it made sense and to see if there were mistakes. But the process of copying was fairly difficult to get it right. So what about all these errors? Now, almost all of them, something like 98% of these, he quotes, errors, are slips of the pen. For example, a word would be repeated. So if I was talking and I said the, you know, you'd kind of pick up on that. Oh, okay. I bet just take out the second the. That's the original. Or misspellings. All right? And those things are the catch. Lines that are skipped, these kinds of things. Now, there were a very, very, very small number, where scribes actually tried to improve or smooth the original. For example, there are some cases where Jesus says one thing in Luke and something different in Matthew.
Yeah.
All right? And so sometimes the copyists would kind of, well, let's just make it be the same. They might have been quoting from memory, they forgot which book they were in, possibly. Or there are some places where, for example, there's one place where it says Jesus, you can tell somebody's actions by something by their children, and another place where it says you can tell by their actions. So one of the Gospels by their children, the other by their actions. And so what you'll find is, in some manuscripts, it'll say by their children and both of them or something like that. These generally are pretty easy to work out. Scribes try to improve the text by smoothing it or taking away things that Jesus said that are, you know, maybe it could be possibly slightly offensive. Okay. I'm skipping a bunch of notes. I'm skipping so many notes, I might as well not even be using my notes. But okay. So, nevertheless, there are a number of rules that can be used to kind of figure this out. For example, they talk, when scribes trying to reproduce as close to the original Greek New Testament as they can. For example, the older manuscripts are given greater weight than the less old manuscripts. For example, Codex Vaticanus and Sinaiticus and Alexandrinus. All right, these are given more weight of authority. There's some differences. The age and quality of the witnesses is more important than the quantity. We're going to see, for example, there's a little thing in John, 1 John 5, a little thing in Acts 8. These are things that are interpolation. Well, that's a big word. An interpolation is something that got added. The way interpolations happen is there'd be a version of the New Testament where somebody wrote something in the margins. We're going to see there's one, at least one of these in John, there's one in Acts, and there's one in 1 John. So probably somebody wrote it in the margin as like a comment, but the next person, oops, kind of put it into the text. There are some examples of this. But the thing is, generally, when this happens, we can look at what are the oldest manuscripts. So, for example, even if 90% of the copies of the New Testament included 1 John 5, whatever it is, if the earlier ones did not, we could assume that's an interpolation, it wasn't an original. I may be getting a little bit too technical on here. If there are two texts of a gospel, if one agrees with the other and the other one does not, they assume that it's been harmonized. In other words, if Matthew says this and Luke says that in some of the manuscripts, but in the others they both say the same thing, then we'll assume the one where it's different was probably the original. So scholars have all these rules, these common sense rules. If there are two readings, if one's more difficult, and another's like, whoa, that's kind of a, ooh, it's tough. Then it was like, okay, that's easier to take. Then generally scholars will assume that the harder reading, the more difficult reading, was probably the original. Mm-hmm. All right, and there are other rules like this. These are common sense rules. We have all these to try to reproduce the perfect Greek New Testament as opposed to the Quran, which these rules aren't applied because, first of all, Muslims don't even agree that there ever was change. They don't agree that there are any different ones, even though there are a number of them that have been found. They don't even have this science that we have. Now, so of these 200,000 supposed errors, if you talk about ones that actually have a significant possible impact on the meaning, it's something like 80. So we went from 200,000 down to about 8. Now those 8, most of them we know exactly what to do. For example, John 7:53. Turn your Bibles to John 7:53. I think this graphic might be helpful to give a feeling for these 200,000 supposed errors. John 7. All right, starting in verse 53. I don't know, is it in the text or is it in the margin in your Bible?
Yeah.
Okay? I hate to do this to you, but the evidence is modestly strong that the parable of the woman caught in adultery was not in that place in the original book of John. Okay? Why not? Well, you know, it is somewhat debatable, but the fact is Codex Alexandrinus doesn't include it, Codex Vaticanus does not include it, mm-hmm. and Codex Sinaiticus does not, and Codex Vezai does. So 3 out of the 4 of most ancient manuscripts don't include it. Now, it turns out at least one of them, after John 7:53 and up to John 8:11, it's got a space there, which means that the person who created that manuscript wasn't sure if it belonged there or not. I believe, I'm very confident to say that this was one of the earliest oral traditions that goes right back to the time of Jesus. Mm-hmm. And they just didn't know where to put it because it probably was not in the original thing that John wrote. Now let's think about it. That's a great story. I love that story. I believe that actually happened. I believe this is what Jesus actually said. But let's say you remove that story from the Bible. Let's say you did. Would any basic doctrine of Christianity be affected by that? No. So what's the big deal then? That's the point. It is not a big deal. There is no big deal. Okay? So this graph might help. And of these 200,000 variations, 70% of them are, you know, not even worth mentioning. 20% are maybe worth mentioning, I guess, but they don't affect the translation at all. Meaningful but not viable. In other words, these 9% are errors that came in, but we know for a fact that that was not in the original. So we're down to less than 1% of this 200,000, which, you know, might have some possible actual effect on what would actually be in the New Testament. Okay, there's a couple more examples, but this is basically the whole list, folks, just so you know. Acts 8:37, where it says, if you believe in all your heart, you may. All right, apparently that's an interpolation, because none of the ancient manuscripts have that. Not a single one have that. And also 1 John chapter 5, verse 7. These three are bear witness. Again, in 1 John 5 or 7, Actually, none of the original manuscripts have it.
Mm-hmm.
So what does that mean? That means it wasn't in the original. It's a fact that it wasn't in the original. So what's the effect on the Bible in that case? None. Because it wasn't in the original. So why is it a problem? Well, the only reason it's a problem is, you know, when they put chapter and verse of the New Testament, which was in the 7th century? So when they did that, all the manuscripts being produced at that time had that interpolation. So, you know, you got that stinking thing where 1 John 5 verse, what is it? 1 John 5 verse 7. That's, you know, there is no verse 7. It goes from verse 6 to verse 8. Now, what if you added, now these three bear witness, the water, the spirit, the water, and the blood. All right, let's say you added that. Would that change any doctrine of Christianity? And why did the person add it? Probably because they thought it would explain what's going on. If you read there, oh, okay, I can see why they put that in there. But it's the fact they put it in there, so it wasn't the original. So does this affect the reliability of our New Testament? Not in the least. Okay, in fact, really, the only significant scripture in the entire New Testament that I know of, for which there's any, like, I don't know if it should be in or out, the only significant one in the entire New Testament that it's not clear whether it should be in or out is Mark 16, 9 through 20. Right? So there's the controversial end of Mark 16. Yeah, I'll let you look at that. I'd say the manuscript evidence says, well, put it this way. Alexandrinus, Bezae, the Old Syriac, and the Ephraim, and the Vulgate, but many, many of the most ancient manuscripts include it. However, Sinaiticus and Vaticanus don't. I don't know. Was that individual or not? I don't know. So I'm telling you, in the entire New Testament, the only significant part of the entire New Testament, I'm saying other than a word here or a word there, which has really no important effect on meaning, the only one, that's it. You're looking at it. If you're looking at that ending of Mark, that's the only significant question.
Yeah.
Are there other questions? Am I mentioning them all? No, I'm not. But in almost every case, either we know for sure, virtually for sure, whether it was or wasn't, or it's so minor, it's not even worth mentioning. I mean, the experts go into it. That's their job. All right? So, there you go. Here's an example of a change. Alright, 1 Thessalonians 2:9. There you go. Is it God or Christ? Well, first of all, the only ones that say Christ are from the 13th century. Alright? Does it really matter to anyone who wants to preach the gospel of Christ to you, preach the gospel of God to you? Now, could you see why somebody changed it from God to Christ and want to emphasize Christ? This was probably done on purpose in the 13th century, as if this, you know, as if this would affect, you know, how reliable our New Testament is, because it doesn't. All right. Here's the one I didn't mention here. This is Matthew 11:19. I would call this a significant but not major thing. So, for example, some manuscripts have, but wisdom is proved by all her actions or deeds. Others have, but wisdom is proved right by her children. Okay? And the bottom line is, the manuscript evidence does not strongly support one of the other. Now, does this affect your faith in the Bible at all? I mean, are you shaken? You know, what about whether Jesus is God or not? Okay, I would say not significant. All right. So anyway, I mentioned these already. These are the only, you know, like whole sentence things. But the only one of these about which there's really any doubt is Mark 16:9-20. All these are interpolations. I didn't mention John 4, but the angel stirred the water. All those are interpolations. Just they weren't in the original. Okay, so you know what's the big deal? These are some examples of minor changes. Luke 3:22. You are my beloved son, and you are well pleased. That's the oldest manuscript. You are my beloved son, today I begotten you. All right, these are some of the older ones. So let me summarize. No significant point of doctrine or theology is at stake in any of these. The Greek text we have at this point is a nearly perfect representation of the autographs of the New Testament. So somewhere on the 99-point-something-percent level, the Greek manuscripts, if you read Greek, how many people here read Greek well enough they can just read the Bible in Greek? Well, if you are one of those people, if you're reading the original Greek, on the 99-point-something-percent level, the Greek text in the New Testament we have is what was originally written. And I can say that with great confidence. Because of the 8,000 manuscripts, dozens are from the 2nd and 3rd century. The thousands and thousands of quotes of the early church writers, the translations of the New Testament to Syriac, Coptic, and Latin by the 2nd century, we can say that virtually 100%. Is our Greek text perfect? No. Is it close enough that it's an insignificant issue? You can say to new Christians, don't worry about that, and you're not lying. Alright, even to people that aren't Christians yet, and you, with totally straight face, absolutely that's the case. Alright, now how about the canonization? Now, who chose the books of the New Testament? Well, by faith, what do we say? God, we say God did. Well, that's true, but it's also not true. It's partially true, it's partially not true. I mean, humans made the choice. I believe God influenced that. But humans used human reasoning to do it. I mean, we know that for a fact, because I could read 2nd century and 3rd century Christian writers, and they were engaging in debates. All right, now, most of the books of the New Testament, everybody knew from the very beginning these were inspired and to be in the canonical New Testament. But there were about half a dozen books that there was some debate. We can actually see the debates that were having. And we can even see the logic by which they were debating it. And when it came down to this, is was this book truly ancient? In other words, from the first century. And was it accepted by consensus of all the apostles at that time? Mm. And if it was, it was accepted. And we know that's how they did it because we can read what the early church fathers said in their comments. Alright, so what is the evidence supporting this thing called the canon? C-A-N-O-N of the New Testament. Alright, what I can say, I'm going to summarize, I'm going to give the answer before I give the evidence. Normally that's not a great idea, but I'm going to do it anyway. Alright, I'm going to give you the answer first and then the evidence. Here's my answer. A collection of Paul's letters, although possibly not all of his letters, but a collection of nearly all his letters, was already circulating as a group in the 90s AD. The evidence supports that beyond a reasonable doubt. So already by the end of the first century, not only were Paul's letters being circulated throughout the churches, but they were being circulated as a group. We know that because people were quoting them that way. For example, when you quote, from the New Testament from the Gospels, which one do you usually do first? If you're doing all the quotes on a certain topic, I start with Matthew. How about you? When they start listing proof texts, they start Matthew, they finish the job. Right? This is already by the early 2nd century, which tells me already that the four Gospels were being stacked together and attached and circulating, okay? So, collections of Paul's letters were perhaps not including some of the epistles, was circulating in the church by 90s AD. The four Gospels were circulating as a group of four Gospels, already by, certainly by 100, but probably by 90 AD. Now, this is interesting. This guy, who was a heretic, his name was Marcion, and he started kind of an anti-Paul movement within the churches in the 140s AD. And he had a list of scriptures in which he said which that the church accepted that he didn't accept. And he gives us a nearly complete list of the books of the New Testament in 140 AD. And then there's the Muratorian Fragment. Alright, the Muratorian Fragment, where does it mention that? Oh, there it is. The Muratorian Fragment from 180 AD. It is a list of the New Testament books, and it does not include Matthew, Mark, and Luke, but it calls John the fourth gospel, and it includes all the other books of the New Testament, okay? All right? Now, here are some interesting facts, okay? By the middle of the second century, the evidence is that virtually the exact canon we have today was the accepted canon of the New Testament. So this is roughly 100 years after they were written, in the middle of the second century. By this time, the evidence says that the New Testament was essentially what we have today. However, there were three or four books about which even some people weren't completely sure. I mean, generally, yes, but there are a few people out there kind of like, well, not so sure about that one. That included 2nd and 3rd John, 2nd Peter, and Jude, for example. Okay? And Irenaeus in 81 AD talked about the four Gospels being the four pillars of the church. By 200 AD, the New Testament that we now have was fully accepted and was not changed by 200 AD. Okay? Now, there was still some debate going on, but the list didn't change. As late as 220 AD, Origen said some people are questioning Hebrews, 2nd Peter, 2nd and 3rd John, Jude, and Revelation. But the bottom line is, everybody had the same list. So people were still talking about it, but they all had the same list. Okay? Now, here's something interesting. In the 2nd and 3rd century, there are other books that were read commonly in the churches. We know that because people mention them. These books, Shepherd of Hermas, Epistle of Barnabas, Didache. Some people, some of the early church fathers said, read the Epistle of Barnabas in the churches. Read the Didache. The Didache was a baptismal preparation thing. It's fairly short. It'd probably be about 4 or 5 pages long. And it was like a preparation for baptism. Alright? Epistle of Barnabas. Now, the best way that I found to convince yourself that the New Testament we have is the right set of books is go ahead and read these things. Read the Epistle of Barnabas. There's just kind of some anti-Semitic stuff in there. It's like, ooh, ouch, ooh. Jesus wouldn't have said that. Well, no kidding. Oh, no wonder it didn't get included. The Didache says, for baptism, he said, running water is best, still water is okay, but if you have to, go ahead and pour it. All right, well, okay. You know, you read these books, and you can tell these people are quoting the other books of the New Testament, and they're not even remotely trying to come across as if this is inspired. So I'm saying one way to convince yourself of the reliability of the New Testament and of the canon is to read these other books. You kind of go, well, that's interesting. If you read one of my books, you would not be tempted to think, gee, that should be part of the Bible. You figured out right away. No, I'm sorry. That's also it's not up to the right level there. All right. So the New Testament canon was selected by consensus of the church in the second century as those books with apostolic authority. The evidence is conclusive that the Greek New Testament we have is virtually identical to the original writings of the inspired writers, and we can feel that with great confidence. So all these people that said the New Testament was corrupted and changed, things taken out, things added, this is a bunch of nonsense. And even if they wanted to, let's say Constantine wanted to change the New Testament. He couldn't have. He would have to get all these bishops to agree to do that, and none of them would have agreed to do that. None of them would have. Are you kidding? They'd rather die than change the New Testament. But even if they'd agreed, what about the hundreds of manuscripts we have from before that time? This is craziness. The New Testament we have is virtually identical to the original Testament. Okay, got it? Very reliable. Now let's talk about the Old Testament. Let me just take 10-15 minutes here. We'll open up for question and answer because we're already at the end of our time pretty much. Alright, so here's a section of the Psalms from the Dead Sea Scrolls. Alright, so what about the reliability of the Old Testament? What about the canonization of the Old Testament? Now, I would say the exact word for word, precise Old Testament is probably not quite as important to us as the New Testament. Arguably. Okay? You know, every single word
is the New Testament is probably more important to us. But we have some evidence for the reliability of the Old Testament. There's the Masoretic text, the Dead Sea Scrolls, the Septuagint, and other early translations. All right, that's a lot of big words. All right, let me tell you what I'm talking about. Okay, the Masoretic text, there were these Jewish scribes called the Masoretes. They worked in the 5th, 6th, and 7th century. By the end of the 7th century, they produced sort of a standardized Hebrew text. Is that good or bad? Well, it's more bad than good. It's partially good, but it's more bad. It's like what Uthman did to the Quran. Uthman said, get rid of all the other Qurans. This is the only one. Which, in a sense, I think probably made Muslims feel more confident. So, from a Muslim's perspective, that was a good idea, actually, you know? But what it did was it destroyed all the evidence. All right? Now, the Jews did not destroy all the evidence, but what they had is a law. The law was, when a scroll got worn out, you burn it. That's just, you know, that's how they treated it. They treated the Bible as if it was a holy thing. And they have these incredible rules for dealing with it. So, every single Hebrew text we have, until the Dead Sea Scrolls, every single Hebrew text we have is of the Masoretic type. So what they had is many, many scholars in the 5th, 6th, and 7th century trying to create the best possible Hebrew manuscript they could from all the evidence. Kind of like what we do with our Greek New Testament, right? But the problem is, if we were to do that and destroy all the old ones, that wouldn't be good. But if we created the best Hebrew manuscript we could and left all the old manuscripts out, that's the best of both worlds. Unfortunately, we only have the Masoretic text. The Masoretic text, I believe, is an excellent Hebrew text because of the evidence, and I'll show you that. Then there's the Dead Sea Scrolls. Oh, by the way, remember I talked about new translations of the New Testament into Syriac, Coptic, and Latin? We have a number of translations of the Old Testament. Some, for example, the Samaritan Pentateuch is only the first 5 books. That translation was made around 400 BC. It's like a snapshot. Because once the Old Testament got translated into Samaritan, that language, then if for some reason the Old Testament, the Hebrew Old Testament had changed, we have this Samaritan. It's like a snapshot. So if I took a picture of you from 15 years ago, we could try to work back from what you are now. You know how they do a computer to make somebody younger? You know how they do that? But you don't need to, because you've got the younger one. You've got a picture of you 15 years ago. The Septuagint, that's the most important translation. That was made, I'm being conservative, probably around 250 BC. The entire Old Testament was translated into the Greek. So we have a Greek snapshot. Not only does that tell us what the Hebrew manuscript looked like, it also tells us how the Jews understood the Hebrew text. For example, in Isaiah 7:2, the original of the Hebrew says, "Behold, the maiden will be with child." But the Greek translation says, "Behold, the virgin will be with child." Well, people say, see, the Bible doesn't say virgin. No, but that's how the Jews understood it before Jesus was even born. See, the Jews themselves believed that scripture was predicting it would be a virgin. All right, and so that's an example. And then we have the Syriac, which was also made up 100 AD. And remember I talked about quotes from the New Testament? We have thousands and thousands and thousands of quotes from the Hebrew Old Testament from the time of Jesus and even. Okay, great. So there's the Cairo Codex. This is, you see, the Cairo Codex from 895 AD. Now think about it. Let's say the Old Testament was completed by about 450 AD. That would mean our oldest manuscript was 1,350 years after the original. Not very impressive. All right? It's kind of like Julius Caesar or Tacitus. But we know this. We know these guys were ridiculously careful when they copied the Bible. It's insane. It is absolutely insane how careful they were making copies. Before starting to copy the scrolls or codices, the scribe was required to go through an elaborate ceremony. All right, they counted all letters of the Old Testament. They knew exactly how many letters there were in the entire Old Testament. And if they had a manuscript that didn't have exactly the right number of letters, they'd burn it. These guys, you know, think of your craziest perfectionist you ever met. Multiply it by 100. That's what the Masoretes were like. They kept track of such things as the middle verse of the Pentateuch. I mean, if you have a computer, that's easy, but imagine doing that by hand. They also found the middle verse of the entire Hebrew Bible, with Jeremiah 6:7. They were also aware of the middle word of the whole Old Testament, as well as the middle word of each book. They also kept record of the middle letter and middle verse of each book. Taking to the extreme, they also counted the number of times each Hebrew letter appeared in each book and counted the number of verses which contained all the letters of the Hebrew alphabet, all that stuff. The extent they went to produce an accurate copy of the Old Testament was insane. Compared to using a copy machine, way better than that. I'm not kidding. Okay? And the evidence is that it worked. Because of the Talmudists, this is a similar thing. The Masoretes were working in the 5th, 6th, and 7th century. The Talmudists were working in the 1st, 2nd, 3rd, and 4th century. I'm sorry, 2nd, 3rd, 4th, and 5th centuries. And these guys were as ridiculous. I'm not going to read all this. I mean, they had rules. It was ridiculous, all their rules for copying. These guys were insane. Alright? But there's still that annoying 1400 years, right? And then we found the Dead Sea Scrolls. Right, 1947. There's cave number 4, where the largest number were found. Thousands and thousands of manuscripts. By the way, only a fraction of them were biblical manuscripts. There are other books that the Masoretes, I'm sorry, that the Qumran community, the Essenes created. But there are hundreds of scrolls of fragments of the New Testament. But I want you to get the importance of this. So here is the original writing. Here is the oldest manuscript we had up to that time. Look at the percentage of that span that's covered by the Dead Sea Scrolls. So 1,400 years is taken down to 300 years. So about 80%. And the cool thing is, we can look at Isaiah. We have two entire Isaiahs in the Dead Sea Scrolls. Two entire Isaiahs. Actually, one's entire, the other one's almost entire. And we can compare that to the Masoretic text. And it turns out when the next edition of the Revised Standard Version after the Dead Sea Scroll came out, they made 8 tiny changes in Isaiah, in the entire book of Isaiah, based on the Dead Sea Scrolls. So what we know with great confidence is that there must have been a fantastically good transmission of the Old Testament, because there are so few changes. So how big a leap of faith is it to go another 250 years? I would say it's like a little, it's not a leap of faith, it's a hop of faith. Okay, got it? And so, and by the way, the Dead Sea Scrolls, there are two types. Some of the Dead Sea Scrolls are more like the Septuagint, and others are more like the Masoretic text, which is evidence that the Septuagint was a pretty good translation. It's also evident that in certain cases we can use the Septuagint possibly to create minor mistakes that came in the Masoretic. So if you look in your Bible, you'll see in the bottom it says blah, 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 DSS, that's Dead Sea Scrolls, or blah, 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 Septuagint, or Masoretic. So the bottom line is we have three separate, very excellent sources of information to try to produce an original Hebrew text, which is the Dead Sea Scrolls, the Masoretic text, and the Septuagint, as well as other information. Okay? Nevertheless, oh yeah. Sorry, I said 8. I was shooting from the head. It's 13. So. Right? A bunch of scrolls. I won't mention all those. Alright. Septuagint, Aramaic Targums. Now, it turns out, nevertheless, I would say the New Testament is roughly 99.5% without doubt. The Old Testament's not quite that much without doubt. For several reasons. First of all, copying of numbers. Now, let's see. Let's say you're reading two different texts in English. Which is the correct one? Americson or American? All right. What if you have two different numbers? Which is the right one, 510 or 5100? How do you know? So, as a general rule, there are quite a few errors in numbers. So, for example, if it says 5,700 men were killed in the battle, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. And one of the problems is their numbering system was kind of like Roman numerals, where you use letters for numbers. If you look at the Hebrew letters, like Aleph and one other, they're almost the same. I mean, they're really close. So the fact is, I mean, I would not want to bet my bottom dollar on a number in the Old Testament being the exact original. But does it matter? I mean, no. Does it really matter if it's 5,100 camels or 5,000 camels? Does it really matter? I think it doesn't. Yeah, so these two Hebrew letters, Aleph and Resh, if you see them written by hand, they look pretty different in a script, but if you see them written by hand, they're pretty close. Now, again, if you're writing a word, American or American, you can find an error. So, the bottom line is, in the Hebrew text, instead of being 99.5% accurate, maybe it's 98% or 98.5% accurate. Okay, but I still say, the evidence strongly supports the conclusion that there is no significant error that has any effect on theology or doctrine, either in the Old or the New Testament. I can say that with great confidence. All right, now what about the canonization? We know almost nothing. I hate to say it, but we know almost nothing about the canonization of the Old Testament. Now, the Jews have the tradition, Josephus said, that Ezra did it. But Josephus, I don't know. I don't know if I believe that. We do know that the books of the Old Testament, Jesus quotes virtually all of them. Jesus does not quote from the Apocrypha ever, not even once. None of the New Testament writers ever quote from the Apocrypha. Now, it turns out Jude quoted from Enoch, you know,
yes.
But he doesn't quote ever from the Apocrypha. Jesus never did. But the Old Testament is quoting the New Testament constantly. And then there's the Council of Jamnia. This was held in the first century where they listed the Old Testament books. And one of the things they were trying to do is they were trying to say, you know, the Christians are starting to use the Apocrypha. They're saying, that's not on us. You know the Old Testament Apocrypha? The Jews never, ever said any of those were canonical. Never. It was the Christians who said it. So that's the shocking truth. So, you know, like Tobit and Judith and Ecclesiasticus and First and Second Maccabees, yes? You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
The Old Testament Apocrypha. Right. The Jews never used those. That was Christians who did. All right, I can tell I went too long already. All right, okay, time is over. When they hand you the card, you know you went too long. I was actually done, luckily. So that's, well, I want to talk about the Apocrypha, but I'm not going to. All right, sorry about that. So we don't even have time for questions and answers, do we?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. We'll take some tomorrow.
And why it has not been included in the
which one?
Book of
Joshua.
Oh, okay. That's talking about sources. So, when the Old Testament writers were writing their histories, they were using resources.
Okay.
Yes. Which a good historian would consult other sources to get an accurate history, correct?
So
the evidence is those who wrote 2 Kings and all that, they were using other sources. The book of Jashar, the book of the Annals of the Kings of Judah, the book of the Annals of the Kings of Israel. Yeah, they had many historical sources they used.
So he's asking that why it is not included.
Because, all that really matters is what's included is inspired. Were there ever any other inspired books written? Of course there were. Did Paul ever write any other letters? He wrote a lot of other letters.
Authenticity can be believed in that, Book of Joshua can be believed.
I don't know if it's inspired or not, it doesn't really matter. All that matters to me is the books that are in the Bible are inspired. Were there any other inspired books? I don't know. Does it matter? I don't think so.
Yeah. So was the book of Jashar just an accurate history book, or was it even, did it even have any mistakes in it? I don't really know. We don't know much about it. But obviously, virtually everything that existed back then is gone. Virtually everything written in the ancient world has disappeared. Okay? What we do have is the Old Testament. And yes, the Old Testament writers did use sources. Luke used sources. Yeah. Even told us that he used various sources. Yes. The fact that they use sources makes us have even more reason to think it's accurate. But no, we don't have their sources. That's not surprising. All right, apparently I went way over already, so sorry about that.
Thank you.